Hello, and welcome to the Bristol History Podcast with me, Tom Brothwell. The Bristol History Podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Bristol Cable. The Bristol Cable is the city's media cooperative, owned and created by local people. This week, I discussed Bristol's dispensaries with Dr. Michael Whitfield, a former Bristol GP and now a historian of medicine. For the 200 years or so before the creation of the NHS in 1948, the dispensaries were one of the major providers of healthcare throughout the country, especially for its poorest people. Nowadays, a dispensary means somewhere that drugs are stored and that prescriptions are made up. But historically, what they dispensed was not only medicine, but medical care and advice, which was given freely or for a nominal charge. The dispensaries were charitable institutions funded by subscribers, that is, by local people who made an annual contribution to ensure that basic healthcare was provided for their poorest neighbours. I quote from the introduction of Dr. Whitfield's 2016 book, The Dispensaries, Healthcare for the Poor Before the NHS. Quote, "In 1750, a poor family with a sick child faced an unenviable choice. With no money to pay any form of healer, they were left to select practitioners they could afford, even ones with no qualifications, except perhaps years of experience. Their local reputation, good or bad, didn't matter. There were no hospitals or clinics that would accept the care of a child. Home remedies were usually resorted to, and that was about all poor families could afford to choose from. In the main, dispensaries were created to provide medical care for the poor of the city." I began by asking Dr. Whitfield how he first became interested in Bristol's dispensaries.
When I was a practicing doctor, I had no idea that there were such things as dispensaries, in the sense that I now know about them. For a practicing doctor, we just had the dispensaries in hospitals, which are places where the drugs were stored, where the pharmacists worked. And some general practices had dispensaries in their own practices. So they used to provide their patients with drugs, particularly country ones. The way that I came across dispensaries in the first place was because I was doing some investigating about the doctors who lived in a square in Clifton in Bristol. When I retired, I took an interest in medical history. I decided I was going to look at the doctors who lived in Victoria Square in Clifton, a fascinating collection of houses. Nowadays, most of the houses are split up into flats and apartments. In those days, each individual house was owned by an individual family, and many of those families who owned those houses were doctors. And I thought, because it's the area I've always worked in, it would be interesting to find out about these doctors. And I discovered that a number of them had worked in dispensaries. Again, I had no idea what these institutions were, so that was the obvious thing to look into. And I've just been fascinated by it. They were around for a very long time, 200 years. The people who found difficulty in accessing medical care had the opportunity of going to dispensaries when they got sick, when they had accidents, when they had need of medical care, and they had no money to pay for it. They had their buildings. I mean, the first one was John Wesley's one in the New Room. That was a dispensary that he set up, and it lasted for a few years, way back in the 1700s. The first one in Bristol was started by the Methodists. They basically said, we're going to have a place where people can come and see a doctor. And that is going to be free for the person who can't get help in any other way. Most people have no idea about the main Bristol dispensary. It was just such an enormous building right in the middle of Broadmead. It was destroyed during the war, so there's very little memory that people have of a building like that. It was run, this is right up until the beginning of the National Health Service. It was run by about 8 individual doctors, each one having an area of the city for which they were responsible. And these particular doctors were appointed. Many of them were being trained as specialists, and they were taking on this role for a few years, very much as a way of learning what life was really like out in rough parts of Bristol, because they would be visiting the homes of patients and things like this.
Dr. Whitfield's book lists some 22 dispensaries established in Bristol during the 18th and 19th centuries. But the biggest two were the main Bristol dispensary in the city centre, established in 1775, and the Clifton dispensary, established in 1814. To give some idea of the scale of medical care provided, in the year 1874, 1 year before its centenary, the Bristol dispensary saw 8,419 patients and helped to deliver some 522 babies.
If we move into the 19th century now, you have this poor law in 1834, I think it is. And there's always this idea that what the state provides is the workhouse, which will supply or provide a certain level of medical care. But obviously nowadays when we say workhouse, it's a sort of spectre of somewhere that you definitely don't want to go if you can possibly avoid it.
The workhouse, of course, provided a certain amount of medical care, but again, it was very limited. The great advantage of the dispensaries was that if somebody couldn't make it to see the doctor in the dispensary building, that the doctor would actually come and see you in your home, a home visit. It was an incredible system that worked very well for people who were unwell and couldn't pay for care. There were also the hospitals, which both would provide care as well, particularly after accidents and or with serious medical problems. The dispensaries also provided care in the obstetric sense, you know, for helping with delivering babies. That was the other thing that they did, which was not, of course, happening in hospitals. And the other thing, of course, that the hospitals didn't do, they wouldn't take children. So if you got a child who was sick, you were really quite stuck.
As Dr. Whitfield has mentioned, by the 19th century, there was some state provision for poor people who could not afford healthcare. The 1834 Poor Law Act meant that, technically, the poor could expect to receive food, clothing, and a minimal level of healthcare, so long as they were prepared to take up permanent residence in one of Bristol's infamous workhouses. We discussed the workhouses in podcast episode number 2, but suffice it to say that the workhouses quickly became synonymous with humiliation, maltreatment, and squalor, a place many poor people would resort to only in the direst straits, and sometimes not even then. The inadequate provision of sick beds in the workhouses failed to take into account the vicious cycle between sickness and poverty that characterised much of the Victorian period. Those who became sick quickly became poor, and those who became poor quickly became sick. To quote the Bristol Radical History Group pamphlet on the subject, in August 1878, the Eastville Workhouse in Fish Ponds housed 367 inmates designated as sick paupers, which was over a third of the 920 inmates in residence at the time. The dispensary system, by contrast, did at least provide some level of medical care without the recipient having to subject themselves or their family to the horrors of the workhouse. I asked Dr. Whitfield what ailments people were suffering with in the Bristol of the 18th and 19th centuries.
Yes, I suppose at the beginning of this period, in the middle of the, the middle of the 1700s, that really does go back a long time. The average life expectancy then was under 40, whereas now we're up to nearly 80 as the average life expectancy. I mean, a massive difference. So people were dying both as there was an enormous number of children that were dying in the early years of life, and then people just didn't, in the main, live long lives. So a major difference. And most of the deaths were associated with infections, the sort of thing that we're in the middle of at the moment, the pandemic. In the 1820s, for instance, there was a three-year fever epidemic in Bristol that had a death rate of 1 in 50. I mean, can you imagine it? 1 in 50 people were dying at that time. This is 200 years ago. And repeated again in the 1918 epidemics, a sort of feverish illnesses that were just causing deaths in great frequency. There was no cure. There were no antibiotics. People just had high fevers and died.
I asked Dr. Whitfield about how the dispensaries were funded.
They were organized by local people, basically. Everything in those days was organized by the local population. They got together a group of people who became what are called subscribers. So every year they would subscribe £5, £10, sometimes one. Every year that would be collected. The subscribers would then run the dispensary. And because they were subscribers, they were given the opportunity of being able to recommend people to the dispensary. As they paid their money each year, they were given a small number of what were called tickets to hand out to people who were felt to be worthy of the care of these institutions. A very different system to what exists, of course, today. The whole organization of the dispensary relied on this, because one of the things that people were concerned about was handing out medical care to people who could perfectly well afford to pay for it. It was up to the subscribers to make this judgment and to decide whether somebody who was asking for help, they had to first of all make sure that the person lived within a geographic area, and secondly, they had to make sure that the person really was hard up and was going to and really couldn't pay for things. It was not up to the doctor in the dispensary to make those sort of decisions. It was up to the person who was the subscriber to make these decisions. The doctors who were involved in the dispensaries gave their services freely. The people who were being paid were in the 19th century, was somebody called an apothecary, they were often junior doctors who would actually live in the dispensary or live close by to this dispensary. And they would be the regular doctors. There would also be specialists who would give their services totally free and be called in, or sometimes have regular sessions in the dispensary to see patients there.
Is there a sense that the subscribers are the middle classes, people with a bit more income who want to have some kind of provision? Is it a sort of philanthropic act?
Very much a philanthropic act. They were people, obviously, who had a certain amount of money. They tended to be people of, I suppose you'd say, from the upper classes, if you want to put it that way, right down to people who are working in industries of various kinds, who who felt that it was important that they should be subscribing a certain amount of money each year to help those people who hadn't got anything. I mean, the thing that really brought it to everybody's attention was the fact that if somebody got ill, seriously ill, the rest of the family really suffered in a major way. And it was crucial that somebody, or a lot of people felt, that it was crucial that somebody helped out here. There's a lot of evidence that there were a lot of quacks, people who proposed that they had a cure. It was very difficult to find cures in those days, of course, both in the medical profession and outside. But there was a certain amount of consensus amongst the medical people about how to treat people. So somebody who had a bottle of medicine or a special electric method, they'd be able to effect all sorts of cures. So inevitably, people would be attracted, as they are nowadays, of course. I mean, it's nothing new. People will always be persuaded by their relatives or their friends that they really ought to try Mr. X, Miss Y, because they've got a much better system of care than the traditional one.
Mike Jay's book, The Atmosphere of Heaven, about the Bristol-based physician Thomas Beddoes, gives some idea of the quack remedies that were in circulation towards the end of the 18th century. I quote, "The range of cordials, lozenges, balsams and plasters was advertised against everything from fevers to rickets, kidney stones to scurvy, but most of what was on offer was worthless even as a palliative, let alone a cure. The herbal remedies, such as Nicholas Culpepper's, consisted largely of common plants, borage, rue, garlic, wormwood, whose administration might soothe the patient, or perhaps the carer, but had no true power in a medical crisis. Mixed in with these was arrant superstition. Culpepper still maintained, for example, that a cake of the sick person's urine, mixed with flour and fed to a dog, would pass the illness over to the animal. Most people had learned to get by on haphazard and idiosyncratic self-medication regimes that were, in Beddoes' long experience, morasses of crackpot theory and self-delusion."
So there's still, throughout the 19th century then, this idea of providing free healthcare is seen as not affordable, or also maybe not morally affordable in some ways, because, as you've already said, it's very important to ascertain whether poor people are actually poor enough to warrant this care.
I mean, one has to realise that the care that they were getting from the medical profession in those days was not very sophisticated, and in many ways was quite dangerous. One of the main sources of care was to take blood from people in pretty hefty quantities. And there's a lot of evidence, of course, that that damaged the people's health even further. This is one of the reasons why the homeopathic doctors became so popular in the middle of the 19th century, because basically they didn't damage people by taking large quantities of blood from them.
The fact that these institutions were around for such a long time, they exist right throughout the 19th century and into the early 20th century. Is it right to speak about decline towards the end, or is it just the fact that they were superseded by a very different idea?
The thing that happened in the early part of the 20th century was the government started making provisions themselves. And the Lloyd George Act of, I think it was 1911, came in and said that workers, mostly men, of course, in those days, would be able to get a certain amount of supported health care. And inevitably, that provided men, anyhow, with care. Their families, of course, were still needing to find ways of being helped. So the dispensaries continued right up to the beginning of the National Health Service. And one of the interesting things that one notes is that the large firms in the early part of the 20th century were acting as subscribers themselves. So the Wills factory, the Robinson factory, they would actually put relatively large sums of money into the dispensary system. They would therefore be given lots of tickets to hand out to their staff and their families that were associated with these firms. So in a sense, this whole thing worked reasonably well as a way of medical care.
The point then, I guess, with the 1948, I think, is the introduction of the NHS. Is that just the end of the dispensaries at that point?
Yep, they totally closed. Many of the buildings were taken over by the NHS and they were all incorporated within it. There's one at the bottom of Jacobs Wells Road, an interesting one, the Reed Dispensary, that became the place when I came to Bristol in the 1960s. That's where the outpatient x-rays were done, and then it was subsequently sold off.
And there's something I think that's very interesting in your book. You quote Livy at the end, and you're talking about learning from history, and obviously your own background is as a medical professional. So you have done this work as a historian, as a historian of the medical profession. But then you do say, well, look, what are some lessons we can take, or what are some points of contrast here that maybe give us some insight as to how we look at things today? So I wondered if maybe you wanted to speak on that for a little bit, because I thought it was very interesting and a bold thing to do. The kind of thing I think you should see more in history books.
Well, many of the historians, of course, say that you shouldn't be doing this sort of thing, that you really shouldn't start delving into or making suggestions about how change could take place. But I'm a very simple soul, so I thought that it was important to question, for instance, whether it's appropriate in this day and age for the hospices still to be reliant on people doing much the same as people have always done in the health field and carrying on supporting them. Surely this should be part and parcel of the health service. Why do we need privately run hospices in this day and age?
You mentioned in the introduction of the NHS being in crisis, and I don't know if you still feel that to be the case.
Definitely. I think the government haven't a clue how to run the health service, and I think inevitably there are going to be some further problems over how they organise this. It's pretty obvious that they're having problems at the moment.
As Dr. Whitfield has alluded to, the advent of the National Health Service, or NHS, in 1948 saw the dispensaries completely subsumed by the new state-funded system. The subscriber system, which nowadays is apt to strike us as paternalistic and quaint, disappeared overnight. As Dr. Whitfield says in his book, quote, "The care that the doctors in dispensaries provided certainly fell short of what the National Health Service provides now." But what the history of dispensaries does tell us is how over the course of some 200 years or so, the British public and medical profession organised its own system of healthcare, independent from the state. And perhaps looking at the dispensaries throughout history enables us to take a fresh perspective on the NHS, which was, of course, itself the product of a particular historical juncture, and in the present day bears many of the stresses and battle scars of an institution that was designed for a very different world. Many thanks to Dr. Michael Whitfield for talking with me this week, and I can highly recommend his 2016 book, The Dispensaries: Healthcare for the Poor Before the NHS. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe and write us a review on iTunes. If you have any ideas for future episodes of the Bristol History Podcast, you can email bristolhistorypodcast@gmail.com.